Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. Here next to me today, as always, is Dan Farrant. How's it going, Dan?
Very well, Rob. How are you doing?
Beautiful. I'm very good, thank you. Let's get straight to the news, because there's a lot going on this week.
Oh, is there? What? You got another gig or something?
Yeah, I have. Got a big one. I've got a major gig coming up next Wednesday night. I'm playing to a primary school.
Oh, mate.
Yeah, it's going to be sick. I'm playing with John Ormston, Ed Barber, and Phil Merriman. They're kind of playing as a trio. Obviously, when I say got a gig, what I really mean is that I'm just going to take my saxophone and I'm going to show up. Yeah. And then in my mind, it's a gig. But okay. In terms of them actually asking me to play, that's a bit more of a grey area.
So are they playing at your school and you're going to be in the audience? Or?
Well, yeah, pretty much. Okay. But I am going to play, but they're probably
going to sit in.
Yeah, exactly. Why not? Okay. I'll just show the kids a thing or two, you know. Yeah. It's no big deal, you know.
Have any of them come across the Jazz Podcast yet?
Yeah. Ed Barber.
Your pupils.
Oh, my pupils, I was going to say. Big shout out to Ed, who's listening to us on long journeys. pupil-wise, I've obviously edited the swearing out, just in case. But people have seen... Oops. People have been near it, pupils. Like, I've caught parents of pupils listening to it, you know, in the kitchen or whatever. And so they've kind of heard it by proxy, but not directly seeking it out. Whenever I tell them that there's a jazz podcast and that I run it, or sometimes like we're like playing along to stuff in my lessons, and then the Jazz Podcast comes on afterwards, they're just like, "What the hell is that?" I'm like, "Oh, it's the Jazz Podcast." They look at me like I'm insane. It might be the most honest reaction I'm getting to the show. so we don't have I was looking at some websites for some news music, but nothing can beat ba 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 boo. So we're sticking with that for now.
Great.
The news is as follows.
I've had an idea.
Oh yeah,
maybe we could get Ruben in on a session to do that.
That's a really nice idea.
As lovely as your voice is for the news, I think Ruben would really get it.
Ruben Fowler, the trumpet player, the man of the hour, he will be. That's a fantastic
idea. Maybe next week
idea.
We can have a little...
We'll hook it up. What, we'll do it live or record it? Maybe we'll try and get him on for the intro and have him play a live trumpet news.
I think I don't want him to play trumpet. I want him to sing.
Wow, that's perfect. I'll get him on. Yeah. I'll get the old voicemail fired up and we'll sort that out this week. That's a fantastic
that'd be great.
Idea.
Okay.
So I'm making a film about Richard
Tunn. Oh, you're telling people, are you?
I'm gonna make the announcement now there's going to be a film about Richard Turner, the trumpet player. He died aged 27 from a heart attack. So I'm currently working very hard with his mum, Christine, and his close friends and family to compile lots of video and audio and stories and all sorts, kind of building my own Richard Turner life story. So there's going to be a small Kickstarter at some point to make the film look good. There'll be more details about that nearer the time. But that's cool. So if you are listening and if you're sitting on a pile of Richard Turner footage, I know some people who I wouldn't have thought of, like Jack Davies, who used to run the North London Tavern Jazz Night. He has some cool stuff from when he played there, which I'd never have thought of. So if you've got a load of stuff, hook me up. Speaking of getting hooked up, Callum Gourlay is running a monthly residency at the Vortex.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's doing a Monday night once a month. And he sent me a little message about it, which I'm going to read word for word for you.
Yeah.
Oh, and he also said that the idea of a jazz podcast is a great idea, but that he's only listened to one episode.
Oh, okay. That was probably the one that we mentioned him looking like Hagrid in.
Of course. Oh, that makes sense.
When I say we, I mean you.
I enjoyed that so much. On Twitter, Trish Clues, like, added him, like, and linked the show, and Callum just replied, "What have I done?" Trish was like, "You're in the news." I don't think he knew what was going on. So Callum's words are these: "The big band residency at the Vortex is the start of a big journey for me. I love big bands and I love writing music, but I'm, this is in capitals, the laziest man alive. Without a deadline or people to actually write for, I find it very hard to put pen to paper or fingers to Sibelius and produce something. So I've always dreamed that one day there could be a regular opportunity to write for a large ensemble in London. The Monday night band at the Vortex is the start of that." This gets really interesting. I'm going to keep going. "I started looking in earnest for something like this at the end of 2016 when I bumped into Ollie at the Vortex and he said he'd be up for it. I wanted to do it every week, but he suggested once a month was more realistic. I still hope that one day it could be every week. New York does it and countless other places have a weekly Monday night big band. So why not London? I think it would give the scene a huge boost. I think we should all, and just bear in mind if you're driving, not join in with this, but let's give Callum a round of applause." Yeah, Callum, that's really awesome. You've nailed it. And of course, it gives everyone a gig, which,
well, exactly,
which we all need.
Especially you.
Especially, yeah, Callum, actually. Maybe he, I should
a house band, yeah.
Maybe I'll hold him ransom and threaten to cut this whole segment unless he books. So one other thing about that project, Callum's really up for people getting in touch with him if they want to write for the band. So if you want to write for the band for Callum's project, get in touch with him. That would be really cool. Especially if it happened through the jazz podcast. And the next gig is on the 22nd of May. Ladies and gentlemen, James Madron. Morning, James. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks for getting up for this.
It's my pleasure.
If only we could send coffee down Skype, then we could get more people up at 9 a.m. on a Sunday.
So am I the earliest one? Yeah.
Yeah.
You are, yeah.
It's good, yeah. I'm surprised I agreed to do it, actually. <This time.
laughs> you're also the first one that recorded remotely, where all three of us are in a different location.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah,
well, Skype. Amazing.
Rocks.
This podcast is hitting new heights with every episode. So, James, how was your wedding?
Wedding was fantastic. Yeah, it was a very special, day indeed.
Where'd you get married?
We did it in where we used to live, in Penge in southeast London.
Oh, lovely.
The idea being that we could have like loads of like family could come, and then we could invite loads of friends that live in London later on as well for more partying and without people having to travel.
Yeah, that's nice. That's exactly what I did actually. And Dan came and did you do some magic at my wedding?
Oh, I don't know if I did, Rob.
I don't know.
Maybe I did.
I tell you what, you did one magic trick, which was that you convinced me that getting the tube to the airport for my honeymoon was not the way to start my marriage.
I do remember that.
Actually,
yeah.
Booked a cab in front of me.
I think I actually booked it for you. Did I just? I
yeah,
ordered you.
You did.
Yeah,
I did. You totally did. That was good. That was great. I enjoyed that a lot.
Dan did. Last time I saw Dan, I was doing a gig somewhere in Sussex, and Dan was there doing magic, and Dan did that thing where he came up to me with all these notes. Were they, I can't remember where they were from, and then they were, I can't remember what currency they were.
Oh, yeah, the Iraqi notes.
The Iraqi notes, yeah. He slapped them on my arm, and then suddenly there was sort of £5, £20 notes, and it was absolutely incredible.
Oh, that sounds so good.
You've probably been drinking.
I hadn't been drinking, and it still confuses me how that works, but...
It's like, magic, James, isn't it? Magic.
That is magic. I've experienced magic, yeah.
The idea, Dan, that your magic career is based purely on people having a drink while you're there.
Yeah, I think that's how I've got this far, to be honest.
Yeah. So, James, how did you get into music in the first place?
It's a strange one for me because I don't think I really remember, in a way, because I grew up... in the grounds of a school because my dad was a chemistry teacher and my mum was a peripatetic music teacher in local primary schools and also taught piano at this school as well. The school, it was Christ Hospital School in Horsham. And basically, I mean, my dad used to listen to a lot of classical music. My mum taught piano in the house sometimes. And I think it was kind of always around me, especially like the school had a marching band as well. And my mum, before I even have memories, my mum used to take me to watch the marching band of the school. And I saw the drums and the trumpets and, And then basically my when I was age two, my granny, my mum's mum, bought me a little early learning centre toy drum. Mm-hmm. And I used to march around the kitchen table whacking this drum, pretending I was in the marching band. Yeah. And that was really the start of drumming for me. And then it was like we used to go on caravanning holidays and it would like get the pots and the pans out with kebab skewers and whack them. And it just kind of evolved from that. So I don't ever remember not playing the drums, really. It's kind of a weird one. I don't remember like the first lesson or the... I guess it kind of then grew from there. I used to, because my mum was a music teacher in primary schools, she would do shows like, I don't know, Annie or Oliver or things like that. And from the age of four, I used to go and she used to sort of rope me in to go and play drums for her.
Yeah, that's great.
So it's like accompanying, which I had to say, I think was probably quite a good way of starting in terms of accompanying 80 children all singing at slightly different different times, you know, speeding up and slowing down to the... I mean, maybe that's why I speed up and slow down now, you know, because I've used to do it from such a young age.
Your time is fundamentally flawed.
Fundamentally flawed because, exactly. I mean, I'll just blame my mum for that, you know.
That's lovely. What a great way to, to like actually start on the drums and kind of, obviously, those were the ones for you for straight away.
I did then... I start having cello lessons I probably was about age six or seven. But I never fell in love. I mean, I think it was because I was sort of told to do it by my family. I know that sounds really, I'm not blaming my family, you know, but I was kind of told to do it. And I don't think I ever had a really strong connection with any of my cello teachers. And when I got to when I was age 11, I had this, actually, I think he's quite a well-known cellist. Sasha Boyorsky was this Russian dude who was an incredible cellist. He was my teacher. But I think at that age, I'd just changed school and I was really interested in sport and trying to make new friends at this new school. And this guy was quite heavy with me, you know, about my cello playing. And it just put me off, really. I just didn't enjoy it. I think it kind of makes me realize that actually at a young age for people in music, it has to be purely about enjoyment. Or, you know, that should be the focus of it in a way. You know, you can forget. I mean, I guess you don't want to completely neglect technique, but you just have to make sure it's enjoyable. You know, and it's about the love and joy that music brings.
Definitely.
I managed to persuade my dad that I could give up the cello, and focus on drums.
Nice. What age were you when you decided then, or that you realized that you wanted to make a career out of being a drummer?
Well, it's a weird one. I think because, like I said, I don't really remember starting playing the drums. It was always just something I did. And I didn't really have lessons until I was 11. And even then it started off being classical percussion. Actually, that's not true. There was some kind of drum kit as well. But I don't think I ever really thought, like, I want to be a drummer because it was just something I always did.
Yeah.
And I think my dream at age 11 was to be a professional tennis player.
Brilliant. Fantastic.
And I think I then sort of around age of 14 probably realized that that wasn't an achievable goal.
Mm-hmm. Was this after a heavy loss?
I had several heavy losses, quite a lot of which I didn't take very well. I don't think it was until quite late, really, that I actually thought I want to do this as a profession. Maybe just because I didn't think of it as a career, I just thought of it as something I did.
Yeah.
And it would always be there. I guess maybe I was 16 or so, maybe when I first started thinking. When I started having lessons, I used to, there was one point when I was 16, I started going up to London to NIJO 2, National Youth Jazz Orchestra. Yeah. And there, when I was in NIJO 2, Jim Hart, incredible drummer, vibes player, was the drummer of NIJO 1, and I used to go and sit and watch him play and just be completely gobsmacked. Mm. So I actually asked him for some lessons, and then I went back to the head of music at my school and was like, look, I met this guy, he's an incredible drummer, but I suppose I could have lessons with him, you know. And basically the head of music was incredible, and he arranged for me to leave school every fortnight on a Thursday and go all the way up to London and have lessons with Jim Hart. And he paid for it himself, which was amazing, because, you know, which I thought was incredible. So,
wow.
And that's probably when I realized that this is what I wanted to do, having lessons with Jim Hart. I mean, not to say that any of the lessons I had prior to that, I think it just made me realize that it's something I loved enough to want to do.
Yeah. That's hell of a gesture from the head of music to pay for the lessons himself.
I mean, I guess it came out of the school budget there's loads of incredible people throughout my upbringing, I can say, had a huge effect on where I am today. I mean, not that I'm anywhere very special, but I mean, I'm sure it's the same for all of us.
Yeah.
But I think of, like, when I was 11, there's this guy, Alexander the Strange, who was just the most enthusiastic guy about music, you know, and he just made it a joy to be, he was a joy to be around, a joy to, like, be taught by. And he, like, ran the jazz group that I was in, and I actually ended up having jazz piano lessons with him as well. And just, he taught me so much about jazz, played me records, gave me names of people to check out, and we'd play it in the jazz ensemble at school. And that, I mean, that was a huge, massive, massive influence on me as well, you know.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, the head of music who put it all together and was so productive in sending me to see Jim, Bruce Grimley. He was fantastic. I feel like I've been so lucky. Like, every point of my life, I feel like I've had someone who's just been, like, massively supportive and helpful of me, you know, as well as my peers around me, you know, encouraging me and challenging me. And
So although it's very interesting to listen to you talk about jazz, I think a lot of people are probably itching to know whether you're still following the tennis.
Well, unfortunately, I basically, slightly sad mood this morning, because I woke up to find out that Andy Murray's just been knocked out of fourth round of the Australian Open, which was, it's kind of interesting because Djokovic got knocked out 2 days ago, so it's kind of wide open. I think Federer was a breakdown against Nishikori as well in the first set, so
this could be Nishikori's time, couldn't it?
It could, has he? Yeah, he's not a slam. He's not won a slam yet. So Nishikori, Vavrinka's still in the draw. Songa's still in the draw.
By the time this goes live, we'll know who have won. Who's won?
That is true.
All right. Well, in that case, chaps,
who's your prediction?
Who's my prediction? Okay, my prediction is. Oh, it's tricky because I could now look up the Federer Nishikori score, and that might give me. I'm going to say the winner of Nishikori Federer.
Nice.
Now is going to win.
Nice.
So, go.
I'm going to back Roger for a huge slam win. I don't know why he's.
That would be great, wouldn't it? 35 years old.
35, yeah.
Father of two sets of twins. I love the fact that the first injury Roger Federer got was bathing his four children. He's just like kneeling, like having been injury free for his entire career, to suddenly to get down on your knees and put your child in the bath and like. Do your cruciate knee ligament or whatever it was, you know. It's just.
Bless him. You wouldn't wish it on anyone. That's a horrible injury. But as you say, of all the ways to slow your career down,
I know.
You know, I like.
Well, I don't think he can. Of all, I don't think he can really complain. You know.
No.
I mean, I don't think he does. So.
No. It's his style. He's like a gazelle, you know? There's no...
He's like a bat. It's the, watching Roger Federer is it's just like artwork. His movement is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It's like his ballet.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he's been injury-free for his entire career. You know, his he never puts stress on his body.
Yeah.
And I don't think he puts a lot of stress on himself mentally either, which is why psychologically he's been able to be so strong.
Yeah, you know, I feel like there's a few comparisons to like practice technique here.
Do you know what? There's I've had many discussions with musicians and sports fans alike about the things I love that sport and music have in common.
Yeah,
and yeah, I mean, for me, it's clear to see, and I love it.
Yeah. So, when you decided to go to music college, did you audition everywhere? Everywhere as in like, basically lots of different colleges.
I did, yeah. Because I had to know, I guess like, you know, going to school, playing in school jazz bands, and going to Niger and seeing so many incredible young musicians, you know, I just had no idea. You know, it's really hard to know what level you're at, you know, whether you're ready for even music college yet or whether you'll be recommended to take a year out and practice more.
Yeah.
So I did. I auditioned for Birmingham Conservatoire, Trinity College of Music, Guildhall and Academy.
Cool.
The first one being Birmingham. And I remember because the Birmingham was really early and I've heard back from Birmingham quite soon. I think I heard back from Birmingham before I'd done any of my other auditions and I got rejected from Birmingham. And I was like, oh no, is it worth like doing all, cause each audition costs like money to do as well. And I was
quite a lot of money. Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm putting my parents through this thing of having to fork out for me to do all these auditions, you know, and I'm not ready for it. So I kind of have a slight panic, and freak out about it. But, yeah, it was. I guess it all.
So you carried on. You auditioned at Royal Academy. Auditioned, and you got a place there.
Well, yeah. I guess I then auditioned. Yeah, Trinity, Guildhall, and Academy, and I got offered places in actually all of those three places. So,
oh wow,
which was amazing. Yeah, and I very nearly chose Guildhall because I think at that time my mum was probably encouraging me. I think because of at that time Guildhall were doing the first 2 years are sort of 50-50 jazz and classical music. And they were like, well, it's good to keep more strings to your bow.
Yeah.
And it'd be good because I kind of played in orchestras at school. So, yeah, it would have been good to keep that going. But I think in the end, the reason I chose Academy was probably just because it was a small course, you know, a small number of people. It was very focused and it seemed like the right place for me.
Who else was in your year?
It was Kit Downs, who I believe has already done one of these podcasts. George Hogg, great trumpet player. Mike Kiwanuka, fantastic guitarist, who's now actually a Mercury-nominated album, right? He's great, now doing a lot of singer-songwritery things.
Yep.
And Sam White, bass player. And I think they had all... It's funny because they had all been to Junior Academy, so they all knew each other really well. But then when I was like the new guy when I turned up.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were very, very close. Actually, that first year of music college was one of the best in my life. Actually, it was really good fun. We were all suitably bonkers, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it goes back to that thing of being fortunate, to be surrounded by, or to have met certain the right teachers at the right time, whether it's, you know, start with Alex Estrange, then the head of music, Bruce Grinley, then Jim Hart, amazing drummer, and then to go to music college and be surrounded by, well, it wasn't just my year, actually, it was the whole course, you know,
yeah.
But to be surrounded by four other guys who loved music and were totally up for hanging out. We hung out loads together, always talking about music or just mucking about whatever it was, you know. To be surrounded by people who like pushed me and challenged me and just like support me and everything, or support, we support each other, you know, and everything we do is, I think that's huge in anyone's life or development as a person, you know, to have peers around you that are challenging you and pushing you. That's such a huge part of anyone's education. It's never just about someone's teacher or just someone's, which college you go to. It's like, it's the people that you're surrounded by.
Yeah.
Who are your own age or similar, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a really, really special place for me.
And then, so kind of as you went through Academy, I guess you're starting to play with more, like, or I guess more people get to know you and you get older. And then, so when you graduated, did you kind of just sort of slide gracefully out into London?
Down to that big water slide that's at the end of Mile End High Street.
Yeah.
Slide, you go into the Thames and then you're there. That's like
that's the graduation ceremony, right?
The graduation. Yeah.
Next month at the front.
Yeah.
Next month
at the front. He gives you a little push.
Yeah, slide of life. I guess it's that thing of, you know, in my first year, I was lucky enough to be playing with a lot of fourth years, people like John Screet, who's now just, known internationally, brilliant, amazing player. And he, again, going back to that thing of playing with people at college who challenge you, I feel I learned so much from the other students. You know, I got to play with John Screet really regularly. I got to play with Zhenya Stringalev. Mm. He set up a residency at Charlie Wright's. This is when it sort of first started out. Actually, I say first started out. I think it was its second time of first starting out, as it were. but he set it up. So every Thursday, I had a gig with Zhenya, John Screet, and Callum. And
we Callum played Gourlay.
Gourlay, yeah. Of course, who was the year above me. And again, someone else I still have a strong affiliation with. We do a lot of stuff together. Playing with John Screet every week, playing with Zhenya every week, playing with, I mean, so many other people. It was amazing. And then the same thing was to be said of the tutors as well, playing with a lot with Martin Speak or Jess Franks came in and did a masterclass, then ended up doing a couple of, it was almost like I started working whilst at college, basically. So I would say more that I slid out into London whilst still studying.
Yeah,
and so when I stopped studying, I was already working. That's something I was just fortunate enough to have, you know. It was incredible because I started playing with people who were already gigging a lot or certainly like thinking about making albums like I started playing with Gwilym when I was in just at the start of my fourth year.
Yeah.
So already kind of, doing some gigs with him there meant that when I left, I was still gigging with him and already had sort of a few regular bands that were established that I was involved with sort of thing.
You're on the Blues Vignette album of Gwilym's.
Correct.
Which, if anyone wants to go and check out some of James's very gentle, very beautiful drumming, that would be a good place to go, I would say. I think, did you enjoy making that?
That album? I think it's tough. I'm not sure I think at that stage I was still very... still very like nervous about making it. I think it's only now, about, I don't know, was it 12 years after was involved in making my first album, am I starting to feel less nervous in a recording studio? It sounds right. I'm not going to say that I'm not ever nervous because I still do get nervous. And I think it's something that should never be discouraged, you know, about feeling nervous. Again, to go back to talk about sport, Andy Murray talked about this in exactly the same way I would describe it the other day, which is, if you're feeling nervous about a performance or a recording, it's almost like trying to embrace that as knowing that it means that you care about it, you know,
yeah.
And that's a good thing, you know, okay, this matters to me, which is a very strong thing. I guess then the next step is trying to embrace that in a way that doesn't restrict you from being yourself, or doesn't stop you from performing to the ability which you're capable of, you know.
Yeah, it's tough going, isn't it? Because really, like, jazz in a recording studio is already quite a difficult mm-hmm. thing, you know. That's
yeah,
not its most natural position.
Yeah,
in which to exist.
So I guess what was the question was, did I enjoy recording that album? I mean, first of all, it was a great experience. It was amazing. It was brilliant. Like, Willem's incredible. Yuri was brilliant to be in that situation. Where, how old was I? I don't know, 20. Yeah, it was incredible. But I guess I was probably quite tense, quite nervous, because I thought, you know, I want this to be perfect. So everything I hear, I was like probably quite hard on myself and being like, I wish I'd done this. I hadn't done that. You know. But it was a real pleasure. Privilege to be part of it and to be there with those two musicians, you know, and the great engineer of Curtis Schwartz. I think what I've learned, I've gone on to try and learn, is that, like you say, it's hard to be relaxed and like recording a jazz album in a studio. It's hard to there's often the dilemma of whether to try and play like you do live, or whether to treat it as a different experience and treat it as like a small, slightly not watered down version, but you know, like a maybe keep everything more concise and take fewer risks and make it about. Maybe make it about the heads, or the, you know, the melodies, and keep the structure quite short and concise.
Yeah.
And so, you know, or whether you just say, no, this is how we play, this is how I play, go, you know.
Yeah.
I think I'm getting better now. I think basically what I discovered, I was with Tom Farmer and we were recording an album with Outlaw. We were sort of, you know, that thing where you record a tape, you listen back to it, and you think, you kind of sit there and you think, it's not quite the one. And then you look at the clock and you're like, well, we're running out of time. And I think it almost is that rather than choosing, you listen to loads of takes and you try and choose the best takes, try and choose the best solos, whatever. Rather than sort of choosing the best take, it's more about, scrutinizing everything you do and feeling I wish I'd done this, or it's more about sort of accepting that this is who you are on that day and this is what you sound like, you know.
Yeah.
And that's almost the hardest thing to do, but just to be able to accept that is the where you are, or this right now, what you're recording, is where you are at this stage in your life.
Yeah.
It's just all you're ever doing is capturing snapshot. You on this day, you know.
Yeah, totally.
It's not about, I want to capture me throughout the past year. I guess all the previous years you've ever had as a musician or as a person will be affecting what you're doing right there, right then, you know.
Yeah.
Then you go, the next day you go again and you just make music, you know. It's like trying to always be in the same situation of just making the music that you're making. I guess it's like thinking mindfulness, I guess.
Yeah.
All you can ever do is put your heart and soul into the music you're making there and then, and it will be recorded, and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
And don't worry about, I speed up or I slow down or I drop my stick here and it sounds, you know, which is really easy to do in a recording. It's really easy to get down on yourself.
Yeah. When you've finished the recording process and the album's been printed and they're like general sale, would you ever go back and listen to something that you've done again?
It's very rare that I would do that.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything. Maybe it's the old time, you know, especially when I had all my music on the computer and you'd scroll through and be like, oh man, I wonder what that sounded like. It was because the first record I made was with Andrea Vicari, piano player. I think I was 18 at the time, and I scrolled past. I was like, "Wow, I wonder what that sounded like." Me in the recording studio for like the first time ever.
Yeah.
And just sort of intriguing. What's funny sometimes though is when you hear it and you're like, oh, I wish I still played like that. I feel like I'm trying to, you know, trying to improve as a musician, and you think, wow, have I like ironed out the rawness, or
yeah,
I don't want to do that. I want to keep some of that. No, but it's but yeah, I guess it's always going to be different because you're going to be recording different music with different people. But at the same time, I think it's important. Maybe every time you play music, that you accept that it's just the you're capturing that moment, you know, of where you are then and where everyone is then, and the mood that everyone is in, and that affects the way you play with each other.
Yeah,
and that's in a way the beauty of. I mean, I guess you'd say that's the beauty of going to see a gig. You know, you are seeing those musicians in that moment, and that's and how they're feeling, what they've done that day is affecting how they're interacting with each other, or and then it won't be the same the next time. You know, the risk they take, you know, when somebody gets lost on one form and they try and find their way out of it, or someone breaks a string on the double bass and you have to play the next tune with bassless or whatever it is, you know, all these things that I'm losing my train of thought.
No, it's fine. You were just reminding me, I went to see an Oscar Peterson gig a few years ago in Liverpool.
Jealous.
And it was one of the last gigs he played. I think he must have been about 90. You know, brought onto the stage in a wheelchair, moved onto the piano stool. But there was a moment in the gig where they played a tune and I've forgotten what it was. But after it, he said thanks to the audience. And then as if he had no recollection, he just announced the same tune again and went straight back into it. And obviously, like, great, completely different, really beautifully played at the end. You know, it was such a great moment because I don't think he meant to, but it's cool to hear that happen. So like accidentally, and hear it go through twice on a gig, because you know, it's kind of like a behind the scenes vibe the second time.
Yeah, but I guess you're in that situation. If maybe he's made that because he's forgotten that he's played that tune already, it'll be interesting to see how the band react and if they try and do anything.
The guitarist leant forwards and put his hand on his shoulder to try and say, "Hey, you know, we've just played that," and Oscar just looked irritated, shrugged him off, and dove straight into it. He was not taking any of that.
But even musically, I guess, you know, if like say the guitar player had played this kind of role in the first performance of it, does he in the second performance of it try and do something different? Does he comp by playing lines rather than chords, or does the drummer start straight away with sticks and hi-hat rather than, I mean, even I don't know, I mean, I wasn't there.
No, I did notice actually the guitar player the second time round played almost exactly the same in almost every part of the song. I was really like surprised and disappointed by it. You know, it kind of showed a weird kind of mindset from, like you say, like each person, like where with him, he played so similarly the second time that I kind of thought a bit less of him afterwards.
Who was on guitar on that gig then? I
shall remain nameless.
Yeah, exactly. I can probably...
No, don't worry.
No, don't want to... It's too soon
as long as they don't listen to this podcast, that's absolutely fine.
Exactly.
Well, none of his friends, you know. Otherwise, they'll cut you off air.
They'll come after us, totally. So James, last year you introduced me to beard trimming.
Now, Yeah.
I'm 28 years old, and somehow I've gotten all the way from, like, I guess 18 is probably when I cared about like facial hair. I don't know, but you know, to get
because you want to look older, you want to, you know.
Yeah, but how? Where was I for 9 years? And where were all of my friends? How is it that it took you when I was 27 to tell me? You literally said, Rob, did you know you can trim beards? You can trim your own
beard. Is that how I said it?
Yeah. We were drinking like a strawberry milkshake.
Maybe with a slight hangover.
Yeah. No, we were. And I was so stunned. That information was absolutely brand new to me.
Did your beard look dreadful at the time? Was I being
No, I was complaining that I wanted it to be longer, but I didn't want it to be scruffy. I knew what I wanted, but I didn't know there was a word for it. And of course, the word I now know is trimming.
Trimming, yeah.
Trimming, Jesus. But man, every day since that day, I have looked different as a result of your words of wisdom.
Life-changing.
Look different in a good way.
Absolutely. I'm now neater, and yet I can afford to have more of a beard. You know, in an educational setting, yeah. I can grow the damn thing as much as I please. So long as it's trimmed, it looks like I give a crap, then
yeah,
it's all good.
Wow. Well, I'm really pleased that I've had an influence on your beard growing technique.
Yeah, you know? I owe you a huge thank you for that. Well, this is it, a public on the air moment of thanks from me to you.
You're most welcome. I highly suggest that no one else ever asked me for fashion advice generally, but you know, generally, yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed trimming your beard.
Yeah, yeah.
Beard's a weird one, is it? Because for me, it goes through like it comes mainly through laziness of not wanting to shave every day.
Yeah, that's where it's mine comes from.
And then it's got to the point where if I do shave, I look about 12. You know, so maybe when I'm like 35, 40, I'll start shaving to try and look younger
again. Exactly. There'll become a point, there'll be a day, a very sad day, at which you're suddenly old enough that you need to shave to look younger. Whereas I, like you, if I shave now, like, I can't even buy a beer. I look like a bit of an idiot.
Well, we're gonna get to that stage, I guess, aren't we?
We are. And Dan, I think you're quite a clean shaven guy. I don't know.
I go through stages where I get lazy, like James says.
Yeah.
I like the stubble look, though, but
Have you ever shaved your beard through magic? how's this for a new magic trick?
Oh, James, I get asked a lot of questions about being a magician. I think that's probably one of the weirdest ones.
Yeah. It'd be great. You could turn up with a beard, you know, with a big beard and be like, look, hold on to my beard. And you go like, I don't know, you do something like clap your hands and the beard just disappears.
No, I've not tried that. I do something with a beard though. Quite often, I have this little trick where pretty much I make a coin vanish and then I'd say, I'll teach you how it works. And I hold the coin in my hand and then I'm covering it up with my other hand. But then all of a sudden, this tiny little baby's hand comes out and grabs the coin. I don't know if you've seen that.
I
do that to make a coin vanish. But if someone's got a really big beard, quite often I'll like, oh, can I borrow your beard? And I'll stick my hand on the other side. And then this tiny little baby hand will just start crawling out of their beard. And it's so gross.
like they've somehow like swallowed a baby into their beard and it's stuck there kind of thing.
Exactly that. It's pretty grim. But yeah, that's why I'd like to get a beard, a really long one, so I can do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the magician. You're in a better situation than all of us.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah, because magic is, as we all know, completely real.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, illusions, James.
Illusions. I'm sorry. I'm starting to realize now that I think I've had too much coffee and not no breakfast, and I'm starting to get quite shaky. In my attempt to be try and be awake for this interview, I'm now realizing I've gone.
You're paying past the price.
The threshold of recommended caffeine intake.
Something hilarious about you that I love is if you type James Madron into Wikipedia, your page is all in German.
Oh yeah,
and
I did know that actually. Someone introduced me to that the other day.
Yeah, there's no English James Madron information, but of course, all the bands you've done, the names you've done, are all in English. So it's kind of a good way to pick up some German skills if you don't have any.
Yeah, how is your German?
It's quite a nice translation, though. Have you tried translating it?
Oh, I didn't know you could do that.
It says that you've appeared in some photographs with people.
That's the snapshots that James was referring to of life in a certain moment.
I think basically where that comes from is actually the same with 2016. It was like my goal was like, right, I'm going to get a website together so that if people search my name, they can find out what I'm doing, like who I've played with. Like I can have choice over what videos of music I've done people see. I can have choice over like the photographs people use on like posters or whatever to promote gigs. But I'm still yet to make that happen. So, yeah, I should probably do that. But I think it basically last year, actually the last couple of years, I've been playing a lot with this great German trumpet player called Bastian Stein. And I guess because it came out on a German label, Pirouette, the record we made, he probably, yeah, I'm assuming it's him or the label would have been like, this is ridiculous. You search James Mansion, you get nothing. Other than like a picture of James playing in Derby when he was like 17 or something. You know? they probably put it together, so it's all in German. But, it'd been funny if someone did it, but it's actually not even real. Like real, not even real German. That would be funny. And it just said it might even say like James is useless. There's no point.
Well, apparently he went to the first shooting of the National Youth Jazz Orchestra. and you've also appeared in photographs of Ivo Neem, John Warren, Kenny Wheeler, and Norma Winstone.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. I like that, the first shooting.
Yeah.
The fact that it implies, first of all, they've been shot, and also more than once. that's great.
Something else about you, James, that tickles me is if you Google you, scroll to the bottom, it says some pages have been removed due to data protection.
Wow.
Ooh.
You have been up to some dodgy
data protection. I mean, what does that mean? I guess I've done stuff.
You've done stuff that's no longer appropriate for Google.
Wow.
Possibly some bad solos along the way. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, there's plenty.
I think that was you, Rob, actually, not James.
Oh, man. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know what those things were, but if they maybe try like a different search engine, maybe you'll come up with some.
Oh, nice. Good way to big up the competition, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
It's time for a quick fire round. I want to see how quickly you can get down this list of questions, James. Great. So, try not to think too much.
Okay. Can I have a quick sip of water, actually?
Yeah, get another coffee on if you need.
Oh, no, that's not what I need. I'm already shaking. I'm feeling really bad about this whole interview because I'm just shaking.
Oh, it's going really well.
Gone way too strong. Actually, Malcolm Edmonston sent me this great coffee for just before Christmas because he's got this workshop. Is it? I think it's, workshop coffee.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I've just woken up and made a big brew of stovetop because I'm trying to start taking in less dairy because my wife is actually trying to do that sounds patronizing. She was doing veganuary, so cutting down on dairy and I'm trying to drink more black coffee without milk, but this one's particularly strong and it's taking an effect. so if I listen back to this podcast and I'm like jittery the whole way through, it's probably because I've taken way too much coffee.
Nice.
Quick fire.
Here you go. Some of these are going to be harder than you could possibly imagine. Tell us.
Have I got like a time limit? I've got like 3 seconds.
Oh no. Well, you'd just be frowned upon if it takes more than like 4 minutes. That's all.
Oh, all right. That's gonna be less than that.
So, including yourself, can you add 2 other people to a dream rhythm section? They can be dead or alive.
Dream rhythm section. People I've.
Anyone.
Bass player I've played with once when we were drunk on a jam session, and for me he's a bass player. He lives in New York. He's one of my favorite bass players.
Yeah,
I would say ever in the world. Matt Brewer. Every time I see him play, I can't take my eyes off him. I think he sounds amazing.
Yeah.
He does Antonio Sanchez's band. He plays a lot with. Plays a lot with Gonzalo Rubicalo and Marcus Gilmore. But yeah, I mean, he might not be someone through history. He's just brilliant. I would love to play with him.
That sounds cool. And what about a piano / guitar?
That's really tough because there are so many brilliant piano. I mean, there's so many brilliant everything, through time, I'd love to play with Andrew Hill. I would have loved to play with Andrew Hill. I really like Andrew Hill. I think it would have been. Is it just got to be one? I was going to say Fred Hirsch as well.
Yeah, they can do a four hands thing, I guess. Give one of them.
Maybe Andrew Hill and Fred Hirsch. That's interesting because I wasn't expecting myself to say that. I was expecting to say Jason Moran or Django Bates or something. But yeah, I'm going to go I'm going with Andrew Hill and Fred
Hirsch.
Let's
say you got, what happens if you got offered a function for 150 quid and had to dep out the gig? Who would you dep it to?
Oh, nice. Oh.
Wait a minute, so I got offered a function gig.
Well, and you've got it. You can't be there, but maybe
so I'm depping out this gig.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm an idiot. I mean, the first thing I should say is if I was playing with Matt Brewer and Fred Hirsch, I think it would take four. No amount of money would make.
I like that. Four. No, I mean no amount.
No, 4 billion. No, wait a minute. Money is no. Yeah, keep that bit in the podcast. Don't edit that bit out. That's indecisiveness. No, that would just be. I would never dep it out. But if I had to dep it out, if
who
I broke
would you
my
like
leg,
to see play with them as well. That's what I kind of meant.
Say that again.
Who would you like to see right. play with them?
Well,
as a drum?
I'm going to say Nasheed Waites. I think for me, he's just the most excited. I mean, I never got to see Elvin Jones play the drums. I never got to see Tony Williams play the drums. Those are two people I would have loved to see play. But of the people I have seen play and the people I've listened to, I've checked out Nasheed a lot. In fact, I had a period of my life, I think it was in the second year of college, where I bought every record he was on, and I basically exclusively listened to Nasheed Waites for about 8 months and tried to be him. I mean, I still try and be him because I think the way he plays is so exciting and so creative and so organic. And so there's so many risks, and the sound is, I mean, he's just got it all for me. And I just love the way he plays.
Sweet. Right. Time for some 10 second answers here. What would you listen to relax to after a long day?
Comedy, something funny. Maybe. Or does it have to be music?
No,
just put on some Louis C.K. maybe, or some Bill Hicks.
Nice.
Stand up.
Especially if the long day, sorry, this isn't 10 seconds, but especially if that was a long day of playing music.
Yeah.
Sometimes I like to go home and like not listen to music.
Yeah. Louis C.K. is a good place to be. Do you have a favorite drummer? Or is that, we've just done that, haven't we?
We've sort of just done that, but I'm going to, Nasheed Waites.
Sweet. Favorite album to listen to?
That is really, really tricky. I'm going to say Miles Smiles.
Oh, very nice. Do you have a favorite UK musician?
That is, again, very, very tricky.
You can choose either me or Dan.
Well, no. I have a favourite UK magician.
Oh, well then. You can answer that question if you like. Well, no, maybe don't, because I'm here.
Oh, my God. 10 seconds. I can't do that in 10 seconds.
I'll edit it so it sounds like you did.
Okay, here's okay, that's good. Just someone who a lot of people might not. I'm going to say Mark Sanders. How's that?
Oh, lovely.
Because I saw him play, actually, it must have been almost 2 years ago now, but he is incredible. He really is incredible.
Yeah.
Sanderson.
What do you think you'd be doing if you weren't a magician?
Well, as I said previously, I'm not sure if it made the cut, but I wish I was a tennis player.
Yeah.
If I wasn't a tennis player, I probably would have gone and studied chemistry.
Cool.
University. So maybe some kind of environmental. But I also then maybe I would have joined the Green Party. Actually, I still may join the Green Party.
There we go.
But maybe be some kind of biochemist. Maybe try and do something to try and save the world from.
Or alleviate shakes itself. After coffee.
Yeah. Hey, do you know what? Maybe I'll dedicate the rest of today to.
Long-term project.
Porridge with a dash of whiskey.
Yeah.
I'm gonna add a question in.
Yeah. Do it.
Not on our list.
Is this another 10-second one?
Yeah, this is... Do you like Star Trek?
I've never checked it out.
Oh, I was going to say, what's your favourite episode after Kit shed, so...
I'm really sorry. I had to let... I mean, Callum, Gully and Kit are both massive into Star Trek. Yeah. And I always... Whenever they get on a... Actually, just before we recorded... Golden, Kit's first album. We were all staying in a room together, up in where was it? Rochdale, I think it was. And basically, Kit and Callum just went on this sort of like 3 hour long discussion about Star Trek, and I just sat there. I didn't say a word for 3 hours. Basically, just sat there amazed, because I don't think I ever knew. I knew Callum liked Star Trek. I never knew Kit checked out Star Trek, but he was just there. Was the knowledge was phenomenal. You know, just going into so much detail. I was just like, this is way above me. You know, I have no idea.
Have you got a favorite TV series?
Oh, that's tough.
That is tough.
I think maybe The Wire. Also, maybe just, I'm going to say TV series, but what I mean is just the first series of True Detective. Series one of True Detective was amazing. Matthew McConaughey is phenomenal. But I have to say, you have to stop there. Don't you dare watch series two. I didn't enjoy it at all. Because I mean, without wanting to criticize, I can say what I want.
I'm
sitting here in my living room on my own. You know, no one's going to be listening, right? it's not very good. I didn't think the acting was very good. I didn't think the whole thing was just such a letdown. Series one was just phenomenally good. But I think the thing is the people that made series one signed a deal in which they said that they were only going to be making one series. So that's why it's a whole new cast, a whole new director and new writers. But series one of True Detective is brilliant.
Okay, two more for you. What's your favorite album that you've played on?
That's tricky.
We haven't been it's listening tricky, to them, have you?
So. Exactly. I was like, that's tricky. So don't listen to them.
Well, experience making album then, which was your, maybe that would be a better question.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to say two. One is, actually, I'm going to say one that's going to be a weird one because it hasn't come out yet. Oh. I think the one I've had the most, or the best one, start again. What was the best one?
So, James, what's your favourite album to have played on?
No, that's not. We changed the question.
Oh, crap. I wasn't listening.
Sorry, we changed it to what was your favorite album to make?
That is tricky again because I've not listened to many of them. I reckon it's one that hasn't come out yet. And I'm still not sure when it's going to come out, which is the new album. Basically, I play in a band with Kit and Petter Eld, an amazing bass player, lives in Berlin, a band called The Enemy. And we recorded in October, I think it was. And that was a lot of fun. And I think it's the most, again, going back to what I said, again, if it made the cut, about recording and feeling like wondering whether you should try and play like you do live or try and keep things concise. This really felt like we were comfortable being ourselves the way we normally play live in a recording studio, to an extent that I don't think I've ever felt in that way before. Like risks being taken, you know, getting lost, this kind of thing, you know. And that, I don't know when it's going to be coming out, but I'd imagine it's at the start of, at the start of 2018, which seems like an awfully long way away. But and I think that's going to be on Edition Records. So watch this space.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, actually, going back to that, I'm going to say one other album that I did enjoy making is Sam Crockett's album. Yeah. Because with Kit and Ollie Hayhurst and myself. But the reason I did, because Sam phoned me up about it about a month before, and I wasn't even in the band when I think basically it was quite an impromptu decision to record an album, and he just phoned me up and was like, do you want to make, so the first time I ever played with Sam Crockett was making this album Mel's Bells. So I'd never played the music before, and I'd never played with Sam before, and then suddenly we were in the studio and we had one day to record the whole album, which is really exciting. And in a way, it took a lot of pressure off for me because I wasn't expecting to be playing in a certain way. I wasn't expecting to you know, I wasn't looking back at previous gigs we'd done together and thinking like, oh, I hope we play like we did play, like we played together that day or whatever. You know, there was no expectations. There was it was just like go into a studio and make music, you know. Here's a chart, like, oh, it's got complicated form. So I was like, well, I'm just going to not look at the form and I'm just going to listen and play, you know. It's almost like instantly accepting that I'm not going to know where I am in the form ever. but that's one thing I also kind of love doing about, you know, if you're encountered with this massive chart, it's like, well, I could try and like figure out where I am the entire time, or I could just listen and, you know, try and make it work. But that was a really, really fun experience.
That's awesome. So, James, what's next? Life goals, music goals.
Life goals.
Any thoughts?
Life goals is, I still love to get. I mean, I've done a few gigs with my own band. I'd love to do more.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had a few gigs that's been with Julian Siegel on tenor, Mike Chillingworth on alto, and Callum Gourlay on bass. I used to write a lot when I was at school, actually, like write a lot of music, play a lot of piano. And since being in London, I'm not blaming London for this, I'm blaming my own lack of organization. I'm just not writing music, and I should be. And it's almost like I've got to the point now where I've left it so long, it's become a taboo, you know, in my head. Like, so I should do that.
Nice.
I'd like to do that. Cool. I should get a website together.
Yeah. Get an English Wikipedia and you're set. You're all good to go.
Hey, yeah, there you go. English Wikipedia site. Yeah.
What sort of album do you want to write? What sort of, because I remember your final, actually, I was there. I think I was in first year at Academy and you were playing some originals there. There was this one that was kind of, I don't know how to describe it, kind of an African township kind of
vibe. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
I still remember that. It really stuck with me. And that must have been about 9 years ago, was it? Eight? How long ago was that? 8 years ago?
10 years ago, I think.
10 years ago, yeah.
No, maybe 8 years ago. I don't know. I'm just starting to lose track of. Once you leave college, it just becomes this massive warp of time. You know, we're all the same age, and we're all just trying to make music. Yeah. Well, that's. I'm glad it stayed with you. That's.
Yeah. No, it was. I'd like to hear more.
Okay. Well, there you go. That's sort of, you know, if you make it magic up some more tunes. You must be so fed up with me for saying the word magic.
Just gonna this podcast is gonna pivot to talking about magic, isn't it? Yeah, soon.
Exactly. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing I'd like to do is just, I think, be involved more politically, like, especially after the year 2016.
Tough one.
Be involved more politically. Maybe try and join some kind of party, whether it's the, I don't know, Green Party or Labour Party. Labour Party is kind of in a, I don't know. We're talking about politics. I mean, it's always tough now, I think, to have a conversation with anyone without talking about politics.
Yeah.
Well, James, thanks so much for coming on the Jazz and Coffee and Magic and Politics podcast.
Hey, that was a little bit of politics.
On tennis as well.
Oh, the tennis. Yeah, of course. Well,
great.
Well, James.
Wow, is that really, time has flown by.
Is it really? Isn't it? It really is 11:03 a.m.
Have I said anything of use whatsoever whilst being wired on coffee?
I reckon there's at least 15 minutes that I can use.
just get wait the last bit. Sorry.
If people want to get in touch with you, like to, you know, ask for a photo or advice. Is there somewhere they can tweet you or anything? Or
do you know? Maybe this is another thing I should get better at this year. Though I kind of don't want to get better at it because I like the fact that I'm rubbish at it.
Yeah.
Which is general social media, being on it, you know, tweeting, writing stuff on Facebook. I'm always afraid. I'm not very good with words, effectively, as you may have realized over the last podcast. I'm not very good with words. So I'm always afraid that I'll write something that's either laughed at or considered, or like offend somebody accidentally, or, you know, because I can be quite sarcastic But sarcasm doesn't do sort of
very well over text, does it?
It doesn't do very well over text or tweets or social media. You know, so I tend to just steer clear of it, which maybe isn't the right answer because, you know.
So if someone wants to come and see you play, they have to look on every single other jazz musician's list
it's
of not, upcoming gigs and
exactly, yeah,
check if you're playing.
Maybe, yeah. But that seems really rubbish. That makes it seem like it's really hard to...
That was me being sarcastic, but...
less of that. It's less of that. No, I think they should... I mean, maybe this is you trying to tell me that it's about time to get a website, James. You know, sort yourself out.
Yeah, it totally is.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe I'll do that. And then, if you Google James Madrid, then you'll find my website. And then you can find out where to come and find me.
Sweet.
But you can tweet or Facebook message is probably a good one. Or email me if you've got my email address. But there's probably only a few people, so. If you need to like re-record anything, just give me a shout and we'll
post-production. There's a work to do, boys.
Awesome.
Take care, man.
Awesome.
Take care,
man. Cheers,
take
soon. Bye. Bye. That's a really funny intro because James is clapping too to make it sound like more people.
Oh, before you go on, congrats on calling it right with Federer's win.
Oh, thanks. I realised that calling a Roger Federer win when he was, I think, like the highest seed left, it doesn't seem that heroic. As you'll find out next week when Tom Cawley comes on the show and I try and gloat to Tom that I called a Federer win. And he's having none of it.
Right.
It's one of the many things he really takes me to school over.
Yep.
So, yeah, if you... Next week, Tom's going to make me look like a complete d***. Our next album previews for Freddie Gavita's album, which is coming out April 29th.
Hmm.
So if you don't want to miss those shows, I strongly advise that you subscribe to the Wonderful Jazz Podcast.
You're not allowed to say that it's wonderful, Rob. That's for other people to say.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Well, all right, fine. Let's do this then. Subscribe to the Jazz Podcast, but then go on to iTunes and review us and say that it's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, use it in your own words. Don't you know?
Yeah, I want to read a review that says, Rob says it's wonderful.
I've been told to tell everyone that this is wonderful.
Yeah, okay. So some reviews would be awesome because we're now...
we'll be up to one review.
Well, we're spreading. We've got enough.
We're like
that
a viral disease, are we?
Yeah. We've got enough that it shows an average rating to anyone that Googles the show, which is amazing. Yeah. We've got an absolute crap load.
One star.
Yeah. We've got a crap load of listeners every week at the moment as well, which is great. The show is in good health. I'm afraid that we're not going anywhere for a long time. A very long time, Dan.
Oh dear.
Yeah. So this week is the last ever jazz podcast in single digits. So.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. Savor this moment, people, because it's going to get very nostalgic that never again will we have a single digit show. Because, of course, we're planning to go up maybe to. I reckon when it gets to five figures, it's enough. Yeah. Imagine how we'll feel about this show, episode 9. When we're on like episode 4,000.
Well, I think we might have to, you know, hand the baton on by then because we may be, you know, maybe on the way out, Rob.
I don't know how many weeks that is. Let's see. 4,000 shows. So let's see. If there's only 52 weeks in a year, that means, oh yeah, that's 77 years.
Yeah, I think we may be coming to our expiry dates.
Fair play. We have to wait for more jazz musicians to be born as well.
I'll be over 100.
Oh my God, that's a horrible thought.
I'll be like 103 or 104. Oh,
Jesus Christ. Wow. Well, our 100th birthday will be a spectacular special show when some new youngsters have us on.
Your kids can take over.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm going, because I don't have any children, now I can have, like, an intentional heir to the jazz podcast. When it's born, I'll be shouting that.
If I have any kids, then they can have, like, a battle to take it.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to egg them on to fight, saying whoever wants it more.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. That sounds good. This is it. From me, from Dan, from James, from Callum Gourlay's capital lettered writings.
I'm looking forward to Ruben's horn next week.
Oh yeah, that's the horn.
Has your mum spoken to Sonny Rollins yet?
No. In fact, she hasn't even listened to that show yet, because she hasn't. When she's mentioned, she tends to text me about it.
Okay.
Because there was a big mum drop in the Kit Down show, which came back big time in my favour about 3 months after we'd actually had that conversation. I'd forgotten what we'd even talked about, and then she was sending me these texts. So I went back. Anyway, she's not...
Yeah, sorry, you were on your way out.
I was so close. I only had two words left. Yeah. When she's heard it, then she can get to work. But I'm, I don't want to spoil the surprise, you know.
We've laid the gauntlet. Let it lie for now. Great.
Gauntlet well and truly laid. Until Friday. Well, that was glorious.
It was so good.
Dan, this is an unprecedented breaking news segment. I've re-pressed record for this.
Whoa.
Yeah. I don't even know what to do for it.
You've got another gig, have you?
I might have to find a sound drop for this. This is really something. So, having just finished the show, I was absent-mindedly perusing my Facebook when I found Nikki Iles has shared a link that the NDR Big Band are looking for a new baritone player.
Do you play Barry?
Yeah, I've got a Chinese one, a cracking one from the heartland of Beijing. They're renowned for their instrument making, of course, in Beijing. The NDR Big Band is a renowned jazz soloist ensemble based in Hamburg, with its own series of concerts, performances at almost every festival in northern Germany, and national and international tours. The band attracts a large and diverse audience. The band maintains the legacy of 100 years of jazz history while absorbing contemporary developments and sparking innovations of its own. If you would like to apply, please forward your motivational letter, current CD, and an audio sample by email. Application/, it's one of those little lines in the middle, whatever they are.
Hyphen.
application-bigband@ndr.de. Deadline 30th April. I dare anyone to beat me to that job.